An ordained minister has decided to give up God for a year.
How the heck do you just up and become atheist after being a pastor?
What I'm most worried about right now is figuring out how I can live openly and honestly.
I am finally free to be me.
I have no idea how to find friends or become a part of a community that's not religious.
What does life look like after church, after religion, after God?
That's it in a nutshell.
This is the Life After God podcast, a conversation on the space between belief and unbelief and beyond, with your host, Ryan Bell.
Welcome to a special edition of the Life After God podcast. I'm excited to share conversations with you from a growing number of professionals who specialize in religious trauma, deconversion, and post-religious mental health. My goal with these conversations is to offer you a diverse range of perspectives, share practical insights you can use in your daily life, and introduce you to some amazing humans who are committed to helping others thrive after leaving religion. My name is Brian Peck, and I'm a licensed clinical social worker in Boise, Idaho, specializing in religious trauma and mental health challenges related to the deconversion process. Today, I'm excited to introduce you to Sondrea Hall, who is a licensed mental health professional in the Denver area who also specializes in religious trauma and helping people navigate life transitions, including support for leaving high-demand religious groups. I met Sondrea online through her Instagram account, My Choice, My Power, which is also the name of her private practice in Denver. I was struck by her thoughtful reflections on mental health and her keen insight into the process of exiting religion. It's been a real honor to learn from her experience, and I hope you find this conversation as meaningful as I did. My goal for these episodes is to expand the conversation about post-religious mental health that includes a range of clinical voices, therapy modalities, and practices you can incorporate into your healing process. You may be surprised to learn that there's a growing number of mental health professionals out there already doing this work. As therapists, we often work with the individual, and what's said in the room stays in the room. These episodes are an opportunity to share what we're learning and to provide some psychoeducational content to support your journey. Note, these conversations are intended to be educational in nature and are in no way a substitute for working with your own licensed mental health professional or healthcare provider. As with any conversation that may reactivate past trauma, please put your needs first. This particular conversation is not graphic, but the topic and content may still be challenging for some nervous systems. Healing trauma is a dynamic process, and it's perfectly okay to step back and re-engage once you have more resources available to you. A special thank you to Ryan Bell for creating a context for these important conversations. If you're looking for a supportive post-religious community, please be sure to join the Life After God members group. Now, without further delay, here's my conversation with Sondrea Hall. I was really excited to talk to you because I was, you know, I think when you go through a deconversion or leave one's religion, it often feels very lonely, and It's really hard to find mental health professionals who kind of know what that process is like. And so I've been slowly over time, meeting more and more people like yourself who really get that experience and process. And yeah, my goal, I guess, with these conversations really is to kind of broaden the conversation around religious trauma and post-religious mental health to include a range of therapy modalities and clinical voices, and just kind of share the range of options that are out there and hopefully be of value to people who are listening. So I'm really curious. I'm interested in the human behind the therapist, like what life experiences led you to become a therapist?
You know, it's funny. I think it's in my blood. I grew up watching my parents work in the community, work in their church. Our home had a revolving door where people came and stayed with us while they transitioned in life. So, you know, I just saw them always helping people in their own way. So it was a natural, I guess, evolution of sorts for me to get in the field as well. Just a natural occurrence, I think.
Yeah. So kind of noticing people suffering at different points in their life, and then also that kind of helper instinct to be there and support them. Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm, definitely.
Yeah. I think a lot of people come to therapy, having either witnessed, other people suffer or having suffered themselves, you know, the whole wounded healer, experience. That's really common with therapists, you know, kind of doing their own work as they're trying to help others as well, or at least going into, you know, a training program as part of their own journey. So that's really, really fascinating.
You know, pursuing psychology as a study, I was just always interested, helping people, like I said, in my blood, but definitely the wounded healer. Just that journey of religious trauma and that change for myself helped to kind of nail down my practice. For sure.
Right. Yeah, sure.
Had no idea that would happen, but here we are.
Yes. So tell me a little bit about your own personal experience with leaving religion or transitioning out of a faith.
Yeah. So I'm from the South, and from a long line of preachers in my family. My mom, my dad, my brother, my sister ministered for a while, uncles, aunts, cousins. That's how I grew up. That's what I was surrounded with. And, you know, church was life. And it was great. It was fun. The music, my dad was also a musician. So it was, my house was lively. Cousins and friends, going to church was like a family reunion every Sunday.
Oh, wow.
Sunday, Wednesday, and Friday.
Yeah.
we were there all the time. So, you know, it wasn't, you know, I didn't leave religion because of some traumatic experience or, you know, some hurt. It was just my own growth and understanding and questioning that led me to, maybe this isn't the right fit for me.
What was it about that? You know, I think some people kind of grow out of their faith because it's too limiting. It doesn't allow them to be the human they want to be in the world, and it doesn't align with their own personal values. I'm just curious what that was like for you when you realized, you know, there's not anything traumatic that's happened inside of this religion, but it just doesn't feel like a good fit. Like, did you notice what wasn't a good fit about it?
Let's see. It's so many examples, but one that comes to mind, we were, you know, the holy rollers that would knock on your door and try to, you know, lead you to Christ. And I'm very interested in people. And I felt like, although I guess our intentions were pure in that we were Christians trying to lead people to Christ, we didn't really show any interest in those individuals. It was... Yeah. Hi, I'm Sandria. You need Jesus or you're going to hell.
Right.
Like, how do I know what their true need was? Maybe they already needed Jesus and they just needed some food or nothing. And I, you know, I felt like we were very arrogant in a way. Just to bombard entire communities to say, because you live maybe in the projects or something, because that's what we would, you know, be bussed into.
Yeah.
You must meet Jesus. How do you know that?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I remember having that experience, you know, going door to door. I didn't do a lot of that as a kid growing up in the church, but I did do some of that. Mm-hmm. And I remember the most challenging doors to knock on were people who were already religious, even Christian, but they weren't like the right kind of Christian. So, yeah. But that feeling of, like, I know better than you what you need for your life, and just showing up with that, such an interesting, you mentioned arrogant, you know, I think, again, coming from a well-intentioned place, but when you look at it from a distance, you're like, wow, I can't believe, you know, how arrogant it is to assume I know more about a person than they know themselves.
Exactly. And showing no interest in getting to know that person.
Yeah. So then you just kind of realize that this kind of sales pitchy way of being Christian wasn't your thing. Were there other kind of factors that played into that?
Yeah, it was just more questioning, you know, the door to door. Why are we doing this without showing interest in people? And then it was, I came from a church where it was the prosperity gospel. So you had to be a person of faith, make sure you're giving your tithes and offering, living holy, to be able to get a good job, to get a car, to get married, to get healing in your body. Like, everything was based on this financial exchange. And that was just another reason for me to question, why is that the case? And if we truly have the answers, we truly have this power sitting here in our hands in this building, why aren't we changing the world with that? It just didn't make sense to me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so interesting, the things that as believers we focused on, you know, seem to be very self-serving. Mm-hmm. And like, well, if you do have all this power or access to this power, then surely there are maybe more important things to do with it than, you know, find your car keys or absolutely get that raise you want or whatever. So yeah, it's so interesting how that works.
Mm-hmm. There were tons of opportunities to question why we do what we do and then why that doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
Another one would be, another example would be just studying the Bible exclusively. It's the word mm-hmm. of God. This is where all of our answers to life can be found. And it's like, really? No one else knows? There's no other wisdom in this world? Why can't I read another book?
Right.
You know, yeah. Again, just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah. Yeah. So interesting to think that you have all the answers in this one text. Yeah. Super fascinating. What was it like to leave then in terms of the social cost of that or the relational cost of that, just the mental health aspect of that as well? What was your own kind of personal journey as you left? Was it something you did kind of publicly or something that would just kind of happen gradually over time? And I'm just kind of curious what that experience was like for you.
Yeah, 100% gradually. I didn't set out to leave. I didn't know that's what was happening.
Sure.
Yeah. I just started to question status quo. I started to, you know, talk about the teachings that we were receiving. And, you know, it's funny. I could talk through some of the misunderstandings that were, you know, coming across the pulpit to people, and people would jump on board. Yep, I'm with you. This is incorrect. This isn't the word of God, da da da. But then I would go a little further. Well, why don't we see what other people are doing, or other people are saying, or, you know, there's other, you know, religious beliefs. What are they saying? And that started the whole, hold on, you're going too far. We're not saying we're leaving the Bible. Maybe this preacher's off. Maybe there's some manipulation going on here, but we're not questioning the entire belief system. And that's when the wedge started for me. Mm-hmm. And those relationships with family, friends started to change. It's like, no, Sandra, you're going a little bit too far. And that was very isolating, very painful. Mm. Again, it was family, friends. Probably 98% of my friend group were church people.
Yeah, like the how it sets you up in some ways, because you know it works really well for the group to keep people connected that way. And when it works for the individual inside the group, it's great. But when it doesn't work for the individual inside the group and they have to exit, it just really shows how challenging and difficult that is when so much of your life is kind of tied to that belief system, that community, that social support. So that gradually started to shift for you over time as people discovered that you were asking lots of questions and had your doubts, or how did those relationships kind of change?
Yeah, I was part of that group that loved to study the word and get answers. So as long as I was, you know, playing my part, things were okay. But I saw levels of friend groups leaving. So those initial questions kind of isolated me from, you know, a couple of friends here and there. And then as I questioned more, then more friends left. So it was, like I said, gradually. And as I became more and more adamant about finding answers and, again, looking outside of church and finding other resources, it kind of rippled out. And then I found myself like at the middle of that ripple going, hold on, that wasn't my intention. come back. I'm still, you know, I'm not demon possessed. I'm still a human being with a heart, and I'm actually kind of in a lot of pain right now because I don't know what's happening.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's so hard for believers inside of that system to understand or reach out or connect with people who are you know, exiting, right? Mm-hmm. There's this almost this kind of fear that it's going to rub off on me, or I'll start asking these questions too, or it's going to disrupt my life in the same kind of way. Mm-hmm. And so it's really interesting how challenging that is for people who are still in the church to support a person who's leaving, you know, because it almost feels like it's a form of rejection, even though it doesn't have to be, mm-hmm, you know.
Mm-hmm. I remember praying two types of prayers. One was, I don't want this. God, if I'm wrong, if something's happening to me, if the devil does have me, please deliver me. Like, set me free from this. Like, I love God. I was sincere in my faith and mm-hmm. my worship. So please save me. But as I grew and just became a little more, I guess, willful in finding answers, it became, mm-hmm. you know what? If you're real, then show it.
Yeah, it's interesting how many people who I'm sure you work with individuals like this as well who've left religion, and the stereotype is that, you know, they've hardened their hearts, or they're, you know, willfully disobeying God, or they want to just live in sin. Mm-hmm. But the actual experience for the majority of the people who I work with and who know, people who I know in the post-theist communities, are people who took it very seriously and tried very hard to make it work. And it was the sincerity and the amount of study, the amount of reading, the amount of like trying to make it work that just kind of showed how much it wasn't, you know, a feasible option for them. And so I think it's good to have these conversations where we remind each other that it's okay to have gone through a process like that, mm-hmm. where you weren't trying to actively leave, but it happened to you in some ways. Yep. And then also to remind believers that, you know, this is a really common experience for people who take, you know, their religious faith seriously, and they ask the big questions. You know, it's common for people to not have the answers that are satisfactory to them. Mm-hmm.
And to allow those questions. Again, you know, that prayer changed from save me from this questioning that I have to, you know what, if you're real, then do something about it, because, you know, I was given a brain to think and to question and to be curious, and I'm going to allow that.
So how has your own kind of personal experience leaving faith kind of impacted, influenced, informed your clinical practice? And maybe you can, this is an opportunity to share a little bit about, you know, the groups that you focus on in the kind of areas of the practice that you're passionate about.
Like I said earlier, I didn't plan to work with religious trauma. I didn't even know that was a thing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But when you leave yourself and you're trying to find resources, you know, who else has been through this? What do we do? Right. How do I get help? Like, what's my life like now? And you Google, and it was slim pickings. I didn't find many resources. And I thought, man, I know there are others that are experiencing this. And, you know, funny enough, some of those same family and friends that kind of became quiet actually came back later, years later, some of them, and said, you know,
sure,
I was pushing, but I was really, you know, making you answer some of the same questions I had. I just didn't have the courage to do that just yet.
Right.
So knowing that there was a community, I just didn't know where to find them. And I didn't know, sure, where do we go from here? Like what's next? I didn't even know religious trauma was a thing. I didn't know what it was called that I was experiencing. You know, we kind of look at it and think of maybe some of the larger Mormon sects, and, you know, our society accepts that as cultish, or, mm-hmm, you know, now that's trauma. But what I was experiencing was something different. At least I thought it was.
Yeah. So like your own personal experience allowed you to connect with others who mm-hmm. are going through a similar experience. And you realize like how isolating it really is. I think that was definitely my experience as well, realizing that, you know, I found people sharing their stories about their experience. Yeah. And I think there's a lot of value in that. And I think kind of owning your story and sharing that can be healing in and of itself. Mm-hmm. But then there's also this, like, and now what? And how do I kind of land and on my feet in a way that I can move forward and just get on with this one life that I have to live, and really kind of focusing more forward as opposed to focusing on like how I was hurt or how things didn't work for me inside of religion, and that kind of proactive moving forward towards, you know, health and healing. And I see so many individuals get stuck there, right? Yeah. In this, I'm still processing through this, and there's, you know, that's can be a very natural part of the process, but then how do we move forward? What's next? I think those are really, really important questions. And I find that in my own personal experience, unpacking some of those in a clinical setting, in a therapy setting where a therapist is mm-hmm. attuned to your experience and able to support your process, give you a context to kind of process through that so that you don't remain stuck, I think is such a gift to give. And I'm really grateful to know that you're offering that service in the Denver area to your clients.
You know, in this process, and we talked about it being gradual, I started with a Christian counselor to kind of help me deal with what I was experiencing. And this person was loving and kind and patient, but the answers were always seek God, the answers are in Christ. And I thought, mm-hmm. that's not what I mean. So, you know, yeah. I went from there to another counselor who happened to be Christian, but was very open in her perspectives. Mm-hmm. And she helped me to consider my thinking and mm-hmm. Some different tools around challenging thinking. She didn't know how to deal with what I was experiencing specifically, but she kind of led me in a direction. And so that helped me form kind of an approach to help others. And, you know, those friends, mm-hmm. family, as I, you know, began to talk about it more, I would get referrals, and I wasn't practicing yet, but I would mm-hmm. get yeah. people coming to me going, hey, Sandra went through this. I think she can help you.
Right.
And I thought, well, hey, let's just talk it out and figure this thing out together. And I started to piece together some of that CBT and choice theory and, you know, things that would, again, challenge my thinking, build mm-hmm. my own confidence and self-reliance and establish my own values, just kind of reestablish who yeah. I was as a human mm-hmm. being. And gosh, it's an honor to help people do that now in my practice.
Yeah, I totally can get what you're saying there, that it really is, I don't know, sacred might not be the word, but it feels like a very sacred thing to sit with individuals as they discover sometimes for the first time that they have a say over their life, and they can decide what's right for them independent of anyone else's input. Such an amazing and freeing experience to have.
Yeah. And some of those, you know, I think for me and a lot of times with clients, the irrational fears that mm-hmm. We fight as we make our exodus of sorts from religious thinking. I thought I would leave my house and have a car accident. I thought my world would fall apart. I lived in constant right. fear. So again, being able to help people walk through that and go, let's look at what you're really afraid of. It's like being afraid of the boogeyman, yeah. you know?
Sure.
You know, there's a life out here beyond this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not that the fear isn't real, because the felt experience of it is very real, and our brain doesn't know the difference between, you know, a perceived threat or a real threat. But then helping individuals, I think, normalize that, like, this is a normal experience to have for this fear to persist. And how do you want to live your life in the presence of this fear, or kind of almost in spite of this fear? Such a helpful thing to understand and to know as you move forward through this process. Yeah.
And fear's, you know, it's learned. And if everything we have been taught, as, you know, we're taught as believers, was to do ABC to get XYZ, otherwise you're doomed,
right,
then that's how you're navigating life. And it doesn't matter that your belief in your religion has changed, or you're beginning to question, that fear is still that foundation. So like you said, it's valid. It's a real experience for you. But then we start to piece together truth and facts and kind of learn about how this fear even developed.
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, the fear is, you know, serves a evolutionary function as well. And so you can see we wouldn't want to be a human without anxiety or without fear. But then that leaves us with this ongoing challenge of, like, what things do I want to attend to and really, you know, focus on, because there is an actual threat, and what things are maybe serve a different function, maybe serve a function of keeping me as part of a group, or, you know, shame and fear often go together when people leave religion. And these, we start realizing, like, how this fear is functioning for me as a human. Then I can make different choices about that. And so fascinating.
And sometimes you have to do it afraid. Like, they, you know,
yes,
it's a real emotion. It's given, you know, all of us came with it out of the box and to use it, use that fear, question it, look at it, give it, hold space for it. Sometimes go, let's talk about this. What is this that I'm experiencing? And like you said, how does it serve me? How does it not serve me?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. What are some of the challenges that you see clients having as they move through this process? Like, what are challenges that tend to be unique to individuals who are leaving religion?
You know, we talked about the social shift, losing community, feeling isolated and alone. But I think what I see more often is, again, just that confidence and the ability to make decisions for yourself. Really finding out, you know, what is it that I value? What do I build my foundation on moving forward? And having the courage to discover that on their own. And, you know, it's not so different when you start to look at, yes, we're talking about this in the space of religious trauma, but it could be a family dynamic, cultural things. You know, whenever you decide to do something different, and, you know, it's not something expected or allowed from your community, whatever that community is, we face that same challenge of, whoa. So if I don't want to do that because something's not sitting well with me here, but what does life look like? So it's a unique challenge, but it's also one that I found to be the most creative and beautiful. And it's like a child starting over, and you get to say, just imagine, just opening that box of imagination. It's magnificent.
Yeah. I think I've described it in a very similar way, that, you know, this deconversion process is both terrifying, but it's also kind of, you know, mind expanding, life expanding. It's so much potential for change and for growth. And that's where, inside of at least a more fundamentalist religion, you're limited to what you can, you know, expose yourself to in terms of new information and knowledge and interest. And so when you have this opportunity, like, it can be this just amazing growth and transformation, if a person's able to, you know, get over some of those hurdles or move through some of that trauma so that they can feel safe and connected in their own physical experience, and then also kind of trusting their own instincts that they can make good choices with their life, and they can, you know, their own personal values are valid and adequate to navigate the world.
Valid and adequate. I like that. So true.
Yeah. Yeah. So that social piece, you see that as being challenging, and then also just learning how to trust oneself. Like what's a typical process that a person goes through? If say I'm a client and I'm working with you and I'm like, man, I'm just really stuck because I want to get on with my life, but it just feels like I don't know how to trust myself. I'm always asking people for advice, or I'm always, checking in with my online support groups to say like, what should I do? Because it's this pattern that I've grown up inside of where I don't really trust myself. What would a process be like working, kind of moving a client through that where they're learning to trust themselves more? Are there like steps that you would, that you're having them take? Is it just processing? I'm just curious what that's like.
Probably more processing is my approach. And, I invite clients to create and experiment and test things out. If we stay in that space of fear, unchecked, unquestioned, unobserved, we get stuck in that place. It's kind of like,
right.
You're walking with a pebble in your shoe. You're walking along. You're trying to get to that next step. It's like, oh, that pebble in my shoe, which represents, should I pray right now? Should I ask someone something right now? And, I'm like, nope, take that shoe off and shake it. Take the shoe off, shake it, put it back on, and just take another step. Take another step. Like, take a chance. Let's practice together. I consider my approach partnership and coaching so that we can do things one at a time. It may be as simple as, should I change jobs? And for someone who does not understand religious trauma, the effect of being able to make that kind of decision without prayer and fasting and consulting your pastor, it's major. It's major.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's as simple as, let's just write the resume.
Yeah.
If that's all we can do today, then that's all we can do today. And then talk about how that felt.
Yeah. Right. I love that so much. I think that mirrors in some ways some of my approaches as well. This we'll just imagine that you've done the thing that you're contemplating and maybe try on a couple different things, right? Like, what if you did this? What if you tried option A? What if you tried option B? And just kind of really embodying that experience in the present moment, noticing what I'm feeling, what's showing up, what kind of fear is there, what kind of excitement is there. And I think approaching it with that sense of wonder and curiosity, like, what is this experience like for me? What might it be like for me? I think that undermines the fear, undermines the anxiety around that, because this openness and curiosity, it's just hard for fear to live in. And when you're experiencing curiosity and openness. And so I love that you're, trying things out and that kind of almost a playful approach of like, well, let's just try it and see what it goes, how it goes, and what it's like. Such a beautiful thing, as opposed to, just approaching it very solemnly and like, this is a major decision. I need to pray about it and do all these other things about it, all this ritual around it so that I make the right decision. It's more like, well, I guess you could try it and see what that's like, happen. I think that's a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's, in addition to that creativity, it's looking at your reserves, meaning let's look at some ways that you have branched out on your own in the past. And it may be, Brian, no joke, sometimes it's the call they made to come see me.
Yes.
It's like, what got you here? How did you get here? How did you manage that, knowing that this is outside of that religious belief that you once had because you're seeking something different? What gave you the courage to do that? What did that feel like? And to kind of draw on that resource. Okay, let's take that and let's use that for the next step that we want to move into.
I think it's so important when you think of, kind of a trauma-informed approach, it's so important that kind of window of tolerance that we're trying to extend for our clients, of helping them be able to, tolerate more distress or, have more resilience and move more freely in their life, have us more of a sense of autonomy and power and control. I think that's just so important to reinforce that. And I just love that approach. you know, giving people, tuning into their resources, what have you done before that's worked? And can you notice what that's like to make a really difficult decision to call a therapist and say, hey, I'm ready to start this process, you know, kind of building on that sense of strength and power that comes from, you know, making a difficult choice like that.
And getting in tune with those emotions, fear, excitement, loneliness, all of those things, because in that religious experience, at least for me and a lot of my clients, those things weren't even allowed. If you feel fear, cast it down. Mm-hmm. If you feel alone, you have Jesus. Like, if there's no space to feel emotions that are, like, again, I said, we came out of the box with it. And they serve a purpose, and let's sit in that space. So sometimes it's not about the next step. Sometimes it's just being in that space and going, what does this feel like? To allow it to happen.
Yeah, sure. So it sounds like there's this really beautiful mix of kind of psychoeducational stuff, like understanding the function of fear and how it works and why we feel how we feel, and really kind of increasing awareness around our emotions. And then it's very practical, like, let's try things out and see how that goes. Are there other kind of components to your approach that makes it kind of unique, or that you feel is unique for, you know, post-religious individuals or individuals who are going through this transition?
You know, something else that I do in my practice is, if you can't tell already, I have a very relaxed approach for the most part. And I know that often these people that are leaving religion have lost communities, lost family, lost friends. And I like them to feel like I'm a friend. Mm-hmm. I do walk and talk sessions. So sometimes it's, let's just move to the park and go for a stroll, getting in nature, feeling the sunshine, taking a deep breath. You know, and I always say, it's just two friends on a walk. Don't worry about it. Let's just enjoy, this space. Yeah. And, you know, counseling gives you the opportunity to practice the skills. We know that. But our clients may not be aware that they're learning a new skill and developing the courage, the ability to have different conversations. And I like to give them space for that.
Yeah. I love that. That kind of non-threatening walking. You know, if you've been around teenagers or you need to have a conversation with a teenager, oftentimes like sitting across the table from them is like the worst option because they kind of shut down. But you're like, hey, let's just go for a walk. Let's go for a ride. Or let's do something where we don't feel that kind of that eye to eye threat that often happens when there's a disparity between, you know, power and control. So I love that there's this, it sounds like, you're describing this very horizontal relationship where you're not this kind of on a pedestal expert telling the client, like, this is how you're supposed to live your life, or this is what you should do, but more like creating this context where they can do their own work. And I just find that, I think that's maybe one of the biggest misconceptions that I hear about counseling or therapy, is that people think that, you know, therapists are, you know, first of all, analyzing them and then ready to give like advice, like they're advice giving kind of practitioners. And in the reality is, I rarely give advice in a therapy session. And I guess almost never give advice. That's not my job, not my place. But creating a context where the person can, you know, see things differently, understand things differently in a way that they're making choices that work for them.
Yeah. And you need that. It's empowering. I mean, that's why we're here, is to get over this hump, learn some new skills, you know, work out some kinks in our psyche and our relating with ourselves, the world.
Yeah, for sure.
Others. And I think I'm with you, Brian. I don't give advice either. I don't tell people what to do. And I've had clients say, I'm here because I need you to tell me what to do. And it's like, okay, let's say I give you something to do and it, you know, fixes this issue for about 5 minutes, because you know that's how long it's going to last. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do when you face this again? Like, let's get to a space where, or how do we get to a space where you can solve this on your own?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's such a beautiful thing to offer that to clients at contexts where then there's these aha moments where they really get it and they feel empowered in that. And I think that's where having all the answers from this external source within a lot of religious context doesn't prepare a person for knowing what it's like to make those decisions on their own. I think you mentioned this earlier in the conversation and how that's maybe one of the most important skills to develop in a context where there's a supportive other in a form of a therapist to help you, you know, trust yourself.
Absolutely. And the walk and talk as well, you mentioned that earlier, just changing that dynamic that I'm not the leader. I don't have all the answers. Let's walk this journey together. On Monday, I went on a walk and talk with a client. You know, we're doing our thing and I can be goofy, and I ran into like a swarm of gnats. So then I'm like fanning and da 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 da. And again, that's not scripted. That's not in the office. That's not step one, step two. That's complete silliness. And we just both just laughed. And it was nothing like sunshine and a hearty laugh. And that's therapy.
Yeah.
And people don't know that, but that's therapy. It was pure joy. And again, we talked about experiencing emotions and allowing that was an opportunity for that client and me to just be silly and goofy and get a really good laugh out of me being silly.
Exactly. Yeah. It's interesting. I think we often overlook how important this is in therapy and then also just in relationships in general, the kind of biological, the human ability to co-regulate. And so we have this ability to, you know, our affect, how we're experiencing the world, our tone of voice, our facial expressions can, you know, upregulate, downregulate another human. And so you're describing this experience that is a chance to share in this moment and the way that you're both experiencing this emotion together in this way that feels safe and, you know, that social and connected piece that's so important for healing, especially with trauma work. I think so often we get stuck in our heads about, you know, there needs to be the right answer or there needs to be, you know, this thing that you do in order for you to move forward and to heal. And sometimes it's just a matter of coming into your body, noticing what you're noticing, experiencing another person, and having that sense of connection, that sense of safety that happens inside, you know, safe and supportive relationships.
Yeah. Absolutely. Letting things just happen naturally. Like you said, you're learning to, we're healing through connection.
Right.
However we connect. And it's not scripted. It just happens. And that's the magic of it.
Yeah. And I think that just what you said there, we're healing through connection. I mean, underline that, highlight that, exclamation point. It's like, that's really, we are such social creatures that we can't kind of function on alone, right? Like if we're in isolation, it really messes with our brain structures even. It really does a number on us. And so to have these safe and supportive connections is so important. And also why it's so challenging to leave a community where you had, you know, those types of connections. It's so important to find those outside of that space, for sure.
And seeing that as a, I'm going to use the word worship.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
Only because, you know, to go deeper, to connect, you know, you had to leave, even inside the church, you would leave your church community and go into this place of like solitude with God. So it's just you and God and you're getting all the answers and you're, you know, getting stronger in that space. And, you know, for me, I found that it kind of, not kind of, it warped my thinking because that was, I was either in solitude with God or I was with my church group and we were still very focused on some plan, some agenda. Again, there wasn't space for a lot of joy and laughter that was even regulated. So then, you know, getting these opportunities to find a sense of, I won't say worship this time, meditation and connect with human beings. And the depth that you can feel in that space.
Yes.
My friendships, my love for my daughter, all of those have deepened in a way that I didn't even know was possible.
Mm-hmm.
Because the source became, number one, myself. And then number two, just those connections and how important relationship truly, truly is.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I think within, you know, various communities and groups, there are these kind of shared rituals that, from an evolutionary standpoint, are really useful in group cohesion, and it can be helpful in terms of this, you know, this human connection that we're talking about. But then oftentimes they just become their own separate thing, and they start losing connection with the underlying purpose of human connection. It's more like, well, this is just what we do. And there's kind of like traces of that connection that's left over because of how our brains work and the kinds of creatures we are. But it's interesting when you become more intentional about connection and you're really listening to hear and understand and how that can be, you know, so powerful and so moving.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't want anyone to think that time of meditation isn't still valuable. I'm a yogi. I like to meditate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're still very, very important to me.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a different intent.
Right.
And it's not to disconnect from the world, because we're not of the world. We're, you know, mm-hmm. From something higher, and these things don't matter here. It's like, no, my relationships do matter. This connection do matter. And that meditation time, that yoga time that I have, for me, again, is another tool in my toolbox to help me connect, heal, grow, and really be a part of community.
Yeah. It's interesting. I've, as a therapist and in my own kind of personal life, I've been more and more attuned to, experiential avoidance, this kind of instinct to move away from unpleasant thoughts, feelings, sensations, right? Like, I don't want to be feeling what I'm feeling. And so for me, I found, inside of the church, I was very much, using prayer and other kinds of going to church and doing all these different things were ways to avoid feeling what I was feeling or noticing what I was noticing. And I think what you're pointing out is just so, so valuable. Like, this isn't just another way of avoiding your experience. This is a way of really deeply connecting to your experience and being mindful and in the present moment. And I think, in my experience, that really deepens appreciation and awareness of our interconnectedness and how important it is, how important relationships are, how important time is, the time that we have with the people we love. And like all that just for me becomes like super heightened when you take away this idea of eternity or this idea of, you know, living forever.
Oh my gosh, you're so right. You in that religious frame of mind, at least that I was in, it was, you put off so much because heaven was the reward. It's all to get to heaven, and you miss the beauty here of nature, of people, of music, of food,
right?
You know, of sex, of touch, of everything. All these beautiful
things. All that connection. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Gosh, I'm glad to have that back.
I know, right? Oh, for sure. Yeah, it's interesting how much more meaningful and alive life becomes on this side of belief. And I think, and I want to, I guess, also recognize that it doesn't happen overnight, and a person has to maybe go through a process and do their work to get there. And I would only want to encourage anyone who's listening to this that it's not that we're just giving these examples of like how amazing life is after we've gone through this process, and in discounting or dismissing how painful and difficult and challenging it was to get to this point. But it's important to realize like how worth it is to do your work and to go through this.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I still have moments. There are things that come up for me 10 years later that I didn't see coming. I've done my work, but I'm a human being. I'm still experiencing life. There are things that still, you know, come up for me that I didn't even see coming, didn't prepare for that one, you know, and it's a process for us all. And that's the beauty.
Yeah.
That's the beauty of not having all of the answers. We get to continue to evolve and grow an experience, and it's okay.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that that process of constantly growing and experiencing new things is more true to reality, right? Like the world we live in, our own kind of physical bodies are, you know, constantly changing. Like we're regenerating cells on a regular basis, and we're not the same physical person we were like even 7 years ago, because like all of our cells have regenerated. And so that sense of ongoing process of change is such a helpful one to embrace, as opposed to this is how it is or how it's supposed to be, because those kind of rigid ways of seeing the world or experiencing the world are just opportunities for suffering in many cases, as opposed to, you know, allowing yourself to experience new things and adjust and change as necessary.
Yeah. I'm divorced and I got married deep in the thick of my religious life. And even the circumstances around that choice, they weren't my own. And no one put a gun to my head. I wasn't in a religious cult. Yes, I made the decision, but my thinking at that time, the foundation for why I got married, we dated long enough. It was time to get married. This is what you do. It's better to marry than to burn. Like all of these rules around it.
Yeah.
I pushed things further. I pushed things faster than they should have. I was not ready for that. Where now I'm able to just navigate and learn and grow and experience people, experience relationship in a completely different way.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really common experience. I work with, you know, a lot of LDS clients here in Boise. And it's really common to feel like you don't have a choice about marriage. Mm-hmm. Like that's just so expected that you get married at a certain age and you know, after you've gone on your mission, you get married and you have kids and this is the life you have. And then, you know, you wake up one day and realize that you haven't decided any of that, but it's just become the life that you have because of the context that you grew up in and the influences that inform those decisions that you made. And it's a really unfortunate realization to have when, you know, you've invested so much of your time and life into something that you may not have chosen had you been, you know, given more options. So interesting how that works.
It is. And I remember one of my family members, and I won't say who it is, but blamed my education. This is why you changed. You went and got an education. I'm like,
yes.
Wow. But what does that that say about our community? And I'm speaking to African Americans, and I know this is not everyone, but this was a group of African Americans that I can speak to that did not value education. It was more about just serving God, being good people. So much so that when I decided to get an education, that must be why you don't believe anymore. It's like, wow, how many people are being held back by that thinking?
I hear so many of those stories too of people who have postponed, you know, a career or an education or a life dream, a goal that they had, because they felt that, you know, to serve God in some way was more important. And then the amount of regret that one has when they realize that that doesn't pan out for them either. It's just heartbreaking to see that, for sure.
I think it affects all of our being, all of it. I mean, I was born into it. It was life.
Right.
So I didn't, you know, nothing, like I said, nothing was wrong. I didn't think until I decided to do something different. And then you see all the effects.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you learn a lot about a group when you leave. That's been my experience. Part of it is that kind of how people treat you as you're leaving, and then there's this perspective that one gains from having been inside and experiencing what that's like, and then remembering all the caricatures and stereotypes that one had about non-believers, and then realizing that I'm the non-believer and I'm maybe being perceived through those same lenses that I used to see the world through. And it's interesting to have that experience. I think it's hard for, you know, believing family members and friends to really understand that. But people who have gone through this process have both perspectives. Obviously they don't have their believing family member or friend's exact unique perspective, but we know enough about what it's like to be inside of, mm-hmm. of that religious way of seeing the world and thinking that, that, yeah, we have a sense of what that's like for them, where I think it's hard for someone who's maybe believed all their life to have a sense of what it's like to be safe and okay and connected outside of that system. And so it becomes just challenging to even imagine that.
Oh yeah. You don't even see how it could work.
Right.
Like I said, 98% of my community, and I'm leaving 2% just because I can't think of anyone at the moment, but most of my community, we all thought the same, you know, different variations, mm-hmm. but we all thought the same. So it was terrifying. Sure. Who's going to be my friend? Who can I talk to about this stuff? One that won't think I'm crazy because I used to think I heard voices. Call them mm-hmm. Like, we could go on a list of things as it relates to that. But
yeah,
just really terrified and alone and couldn't imagine life outside of it.
Yeah. And I think that's also why when a person goes through this process and they speak to maybe a secular person who was raised secular, never were part of a religious community, it's just really hard to explain what that's like and for them to understand that, because so often it's like, oh, well, that was never true. So why does it bother you anymore? Or why was that an issue? And it's really easy to think of it and through this very cognitive lens and kind of forgetting that kind of social piece, that kind of physical experience, like what it was like to actually to experience religion with your whole being in some ways. And that doesn't just change because you swap out beliefs. You know, there's a process of healing from that and coming back into your own body, coming back into a sense of your own autonomy and your ability to make decisions. And I think that's where I think my understanding of trauma is that we when we needed to do something to protect ourselves or to, you know, exercise our own autonomy, but we were prohibited from doing that or prevented from doing that, that sense of powerlessness, that sense of I can't do what needs to be done, is kind of where trauma lives. And we think about, if we look at people's religious experiences through that lens of like how maybe we wanted to do something, but we're prohibited from doing that, or we're told we had to do something that we weren't ready to do or wasn't good for us to do, but we felt the pressure we had to do that. You start to lose a sense of your own being. Like I can freely choose what's right for me, and I have to defer that to someone else or something else. And you think about that extended over a period of time, then you end up with, you know, this complex trauma, you know, frankly, this sense that I don't have my own autonomy. I don't have my own power, my own ability to make choices for myself.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can do the start and then go back, start and go back. That's what I did. Mm-hmm. Like, I must be off. I must be wrong. Mm-hmm. I gotta go right. back. And it's again, you're kind of frozen in trauma.
Yeah. Yeah, we think about, you know, that kind of freeze response, you know, where most people are familiar with the fight or flight, you know, the kind of fleeing or running or you know, fighting off. But then there's that kind of last resort, you know, biological response that mammals have, where we just kind of freeze and collapse. Mm-hmm. And it's that kind of powerless place. It's protective. It serves an evolutionary function. But it's also really can be very traumatizing. And you think about how it's not that a person's being held down against their will inside of religion, but there's this kind of underlying sense of like, you're not your own person. We have the answers for you. You're going to do it wrong. You know, this, all this kind of undermining, this kind of this subtle pressure that holds a person down. And you don't realize the overall effect of that until you wake up one day and you realize like, I've never felt like my own person. I never felt safe. I never felt like my voice on its own was valid. And I think that's where we start looking at, you know, this through a trauma-informed lens, then we start seeing how these systems and structures can be, you know, quite mm-hmm. harmful.
You know, you talk about the freezing. I contemplated pretending I could just stay here. I know all the moves.
Yes.
I know all the songs. I know the scripture. No one would know any difference. I don't have to do this. I could just stay here. But I still allow myself to have experiences. So little by little, I gain the confidence to step out a little bit more. Just little by little. And then it just became, I finally got to a place where I said, this is not living. I will not lie. If there's anything I've learned, the value of being honest, you know, not just being honest so you don't, you know, go to hell, but being honest about who you are. And that became more important to me than what anyone else thought about me, of any fear that I had to face. I just thought, I get one shot at this life, and I wanted to be an honest one.
Yeah, love that. Yeah, it's amazing. You know, as you were describing that kind of slowly moving out and kind of gaining a sense of control and trust in yourself, I think it's important to talk about that, to remind people that moving through this process might not think it's going to be traumatic when you're going through it at first, but then you get into the thick of it and you're like, wow, this is really challenging on so many different levels. And to give yourself permission to not do more than you're capable of, this, you know, making sure you have the resources you need before you take that next step. And otherwise you risk, you know, kind of re-traumatizing yourself. And so I think it's just so important to keep that in mind, that there's no need to do this all at once, or it may not even be, you know, it's probably not even helpful to do it all at once, but moving through this process in a way that you start to slowly regain more and more of your, you know, sense of autonomy and control and power, and then also, you know, develop more and more resources so that you can take those next steps and those next steps. I think that's, we think about treating trauma like there's, it's easy to re-traumatize a person by going too fast and kind of titrating that, where a person, you know, moves a little bit further and feels the discomfort of that, but then it comes back to a place of resources and moves a little bit further. And over time, that certainly opens up their life, and, you know, that window of tolerance is opened wider.
Absolutely. Be patient with yourself. Be kind to yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, that brings us to the point of our conversation where I really wanted to ask you, what are some of those things you would like to say to a person who's going through this process, whether it's, you know, a skill or a practice that you'd recommend, or simply those affirmations that you were just sharing, you know, be kind to yourself, take it easy, go slow. I'm just curious, kind of from a mental health perspective, what are some kind of messages you would like people to take from this conversation?
I always go back to, and this is really related to my personal experience because I was born into it, is to allow yourself to be like a child. Again, to create, to experience, to run as fast as you can and fall. Allow the bloody knees. Just again, be patient, be kind to yourself. You're growing, you're learning, you're literally learning to walk all over again. You're literally learning to read, to write. And that's true because it can be a simple word. I just had a conversation with a friend last week about fasting. And we talked about the health benefits of intermittent fasting. And he goes, no, fasting just takes me back to that first stuff. And it's like, wow, like that's real. We have to really look at definitions of words. Like you're really starting over. Mm-hmm. And again, be patient, be kind with yourself.
Yeah, I think that self-compassion piece, that kindness that you're referring to is just, I mean, it's so important for mental health in general, but I think especially going through this process where there's so often a lot of kind of self-doubt or questioning or, you know, pressure from external sources about, you know, your choices are evil or bad or not, you know, not how you're supposed to live your life. There's just so much pressure there and opportunities for judgment and harsh and critical words and thoughts about oneself. To offer yourself kindness and compassion is just so vital. I love the idea of being like a child as well. I think for me, so much of mental wellness is curiosity and openness and that sense of wonder and exploring the world, which is quite the opposite of having all the answers and having things figured out and very rigid and black and white ways of seeing the world. And I think that's a beautiful thing to recover through this process, that sense of wonder and trying new things and being, you know, kind of patient and kind with oneself.
Yeah. It's funny. I have a daughter and she'll be 3 this summer and yay. And I'm always so excited to hear what she thinks, to hear what she wants, to hear what she doesn't want.
Yeah.
It's like, I couldn't wait for her to say words and now she has them. And I'm so excited. Do you want a grilled cheese? Mm-hmm. No, mama. You know, I want noodles. Like it's, and I respect that decision, I respect that choice. So we want to see that in kids. And we become adults and now we're stuck into these boxes of who we should be.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think as you're saying that, I'm reminded of, you know, raising my own 2 boys as well, this, that sense of wonder and excitement and not wanting to, you know, say no all the time, right? But to say yes most of the time, and this yes and yes, I understand you want this, and here's this other option. But really, that sense of choice and options, and I know that I think in general we are born a bit more open to the world, and we're taking in more experiences, and then as we develop language and categories and labels, we start to kind of become more narrow and rigid as we get older. But I think what you're describing about how you're treating your daughter, and as I'm thinking about how I'm raising my boys as well, I didn't have that when I was growing up in the church. Yeah. I was put in a box like from day one, like you're sinful and desperately wicked, right? Absolutely. You know, and like, yeah. And so that becomes, yeah, it's so interesting how I think that natural exploring and wonder and questioning, right? My 5-year-old came home the other week from school and was talking about, you know, God and Jesus, and he doesn't go to religious school or anything. So I was kind of curious about that conversation. He's like, oh yeah, like God made the sun and Jesus made the moon. I'm like, oh, that's cool. And we're just kind of talking about it and exploring that. And it wasn't like I needed to tell him he was right or wrong. We're just like, oh, that's interesting. Like, tell me more. Yeah. And he's like, oh yeah, God and Jesus, they both died and they got buried next to each other in the cemetery. I'm like, okay, like super fascinating. I didn't know this story, right? And to realize I didn't have to correct him or change that. I was just like, this is a little boy who has an imagination, is talking to some friends at school about God, I guess. But yeah, to see that as an opportunity to explore and be curious as opposed to a threat or something that needs to be changed or challenged.
Absolutely. We just learned about Hanukkah, not just a few months ago, but it was the book she picked out at the bookstore. And, you know, the old religious mind would have been like, no, need a good book about Jesus. And I thought, oh, okay, let's read it. Let's find out what this story is. It's just leaving fear and just allowing exploration. And allowing exploration and watching it through the eyes of my kid.
It's really a beautiful thing. It really is. I think that's been a real gift to see that through non-religious kids that I'm raising, you know, that sense of wonder and seeing the world and questioning and it's super, super, super great. Awesome. Well, I know our time's up today and I just want to really thank you for taking the time to have this conversation. I think it's really important to talk about these issues from a mental health standpoint and how we can learn more about our experience. And hopefully this will be valuable to those who are listening. I want you to know that I just really, really appreciate the work that you're doing too. And thank you for what you're putting out in the world. And your voice is important and want to magnify that, amplify that. I hope people reach out to you. I just really, really am grateful to have you in my life. And, you know, what you're sharing online has been super encouraging and helpful for me as well.
Oh, Brian, we talked about connection and I'll cry at the drop of a hat. Okay. I appreciate you too so much. I'm thankful that we connected and we instantly hit it off. We're like strangers.
Yes, I know. Yeah.
Sojourners together in this path now. And sure. It's amazing. So thank you for this opportunity. I enjoy all of our conversations.
Yeah, for sure.
Pretty cool. Thank you.
Yeah. So if people do want to reach out to you, I'll include some links in the show notes as well. But is there a website or something? Not everyone goes to the show notes, as it turns out. So if you have a website or a place where people can contact you that you can share now, that would be super great.
Sure. MyChoiceMyPower.com. MyChoiceMyPower on Instagram, Facebook, MyChoiceMyPower.com.
Nice. MyChoiceMyPower. Love it. Such a great practice name. Awesome. Great. Well, thanks again. It's been just a delight to talk to you today, and I look forward to catching up with you soon.
Awesome. Thank you, Brian.
I'm so glad you joined us today for this special edition of the podcast. If you found this episode helpful, I would love to hear from you. I have several conversations lined up with other mental health professionals who work with religious trauma or specialize in post-religious mental health. Let me know what topics you would like us to explore, and be sure to share the podcast with those who would benefit from this content. You can follow Life After God on social media to stay in the loop and discover new resources, like the live panel discussion we will be hosting on June 28th about facing grief and loss after God. You can find more information at lifeaftergod.org. Thanks again for being part of the Life After God community.